Please help me welcome our speaker tonight, Eric, from the Mercer Street Group in Princeton, New Jersey.
Good evening. My name is Eric. I'm an alcoholic. And I was just telling Tim, I rode out here, he drove me out here, that I'm glad you read that set-aside prayer, because it kind of keeps me safe in case I say anything that upsets anybody. You should have said your prayer, and you're in God's hands now. I got sober March 21st, 1986. So it's been a little while. I was young when I came into these rooms, and I desperately needed to be here. I didn't know how badly I needed to be here. It took quite a while for me to realize exactly what it was that I was dealing with. I grew up in an alcoholic household. My dad's an alcoholic. My older brothers are alcoholics. All my brothers are alcoholics. Aunts, uncles, you name it. I mean, everybody's alcoholic except for my poor mother. She was just tailor-made to be an Al-Anon. And, she's just been through it, and she's just an amazing woman. She's kind of hung in there with all of us and been drugged through the mud, all over the hot coals, you name it, and she is still there, which is, I don't know. There's no way I would ever hang in there with her. I don't even want to hang in there with me, let alone with someone else, you know, and she did it. So I'm very fortunate for that. When I first came to AA, I thought that I had an alcohol problem. I drank, caused me a lot of problems, and so on. And I thought that, you know, if I put down the drink, the problems will go away. And, you know, I just had no clue what it was that I was dealing with. And for a number of years, sitting in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, I tried to treat an alcohol problem. And I got sicker and sicker and sicker and experienced a world of pain sitting in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And what was really scary about that was that I was hearing a number of different messages throughout the rooms. I'm sure if you've been to other meetings, you hear a variety of different messages. There's solution-based meetings. I understand. I heard a lot about the big book, the 12 steps and all that stuff. I know this is a solution-based meeting. I am in safe territory. Outside, in other meetings, they're not all solution-based meetings. There's other meetings that where alcohol is your problem, and you just don't drink no matter what. And, you know, if you did drink, well, they made a choice, you know. I sponsor women too, by the way. A lot of people get a little freaked out by that. I do it only after I have my wife's permission to do it. And I do go to her first, and I do, if any woman asks me to be a sponsor, the first thing I do is I say, if my wife approves, then it's fine. But if she doesn't, then I can't help you. I'll help you find someone else, but I can't take you through the 12 steps. So there was a girl that I was sponsoring, and she went out, and, I was bumping into a number of her friends, and they would come up and say, well, what happened to her? And ask all these questions. I said, what do you mean what happened? I mean, she's alcoholic. I mean, this kind of stuff happens. I mean, alcoholics drink. I'm not surprised. I'm never surprised when I hear that someone went out and drank. You know, we do have this thing called a strange mental blank spot. You know, strange mental blank spot. That's not a choice. But people came up, and they were like, oh, you know, she really chose to drink. You know, that was her choice. It's what she wanted to do. And I just have a hard time with that, knowing what it is that we're facing. And my response was, you know very little about alcoholism if you believe that was her choice. You know very little about what we're really dealing with here. Because this is not a matter of choice. This is not a matter of choice. If it was a matter of choice, we wouldn't need 2 through 12. Wouldn't it? Just wouldn't need it. I didn't know that for the first couple of years that I was here. I was doing a lot of white knuckling. And I was experiencing a lot of the stuff that I felt when I came out of the womb. The truth is when I came out of the womb, I could have used a drink. I came out with a resentment. I came out full of fear. I came out with this ego. I'm a better baby than any other baby. I'm better than my brothers and all this stuff, but I'm not good enough and all that garbage. And I'm sure you can relate to that. The best way, I heard this guy, I don't know if you guys ever heard of Mickey Bush. He described it, he said, it's like being a big old, excuse the language, turd on a wedding cake. And I could identify with that. I was like, that's the way I feel. You take this beautiful thing and then you plop me there. And that's how I felt. Now, no one came up to me necessarily. I might have got teased a little bit in school, but no one came up to me and said, Eric, you're like a turd on a wedding cake. You know, but that's how I felt. And that's what I thought you thought of me. And I spent my entire life obsessing over what I think you think of me. What I think you think of me. And I'm convinced I know what it is. And the problem with that is that I have no clue what it is, but I think it's really negative. Now what I have to do, I've got to prepare myself to go out into the world to see all of you who have all these negative thoughts about me, right? So I've got to get up this shield, I've got to get my armor on, and then I've got to behave in a way that I think you want me to behave in order for you to approve of me, right? For me to fit in, for me to be accepted, and no idea who I am, what I'm doing. I'm just doing what I think you want me to do so that I feel better about me, and it never worked. It never worked. I always failed. It always, always failed. And I did that from day one. I did that from as young as I can remember, and it just never made me feel like I fit in, man. I always felt different and less than. My first drink at a really young age, got sober at a really young age, but even younger, I had a first drink. My father is an alcoholic, like I said, and his deal was he would come home from work every single day and he'd make a pitcher of Manhattans. They would go into the in the refrigerator, and he'd always have a case of beer. So he's drinking beer, drinking his Manhattans, and I was allowed to sip off of his beer, sip off of his Manhattans. The weekends were spent in a similar way where my father would sit in a chair and, it was his Manhattan in one hand. My mom was on the other side of the living room, had a Manhattan in her hand. She's doing knitting or reading her book. My father's watching the golf. They both smoked Winston, so the house was filled with smoke. You could smell the alcohol. And I would sit on the other end of the couch, and I'd bounce in between the two of them, sipping off their drinks. Now, I couldn't care less what my mother was reading, and I didn't particularly care much for golf because my dad was trying to, force feed me golf all the time. So I would just sit there, watch the golf with them, and sip off the drinks. And they would let me do that a number of times, and then, I would hit the wall, and they'd say, "You can't have any more." It's all right. And that was, it was a bit of a problem for me. It was not that big of a deal because what I figured was that I could go into the source. I can go to the kitchen and get it right out of the refrigerator. And the way the kitchen was set up, I could open the refrigerator door and I could step inside, almost inside of the refrigerator, and I was shielded by the door. And I can pull the pitcher out and I can drink right out of the pitcher and put it back in and close the refrigerator door, and they wouldn't know the difference. And I didn't worry about smelling like alcohol because they were letting me sip out the drinks. So it wasn't a big deal. And I did that every single weekend. I would do that all the time, every opportunity I got. And what was crazy about that, and I still don't understand what happened and why, is that I never felt the effects of alcohol from that. I mean, I felt the burn when it would go down. I liked the burn. And I liked the sense that I was, drinking alcohol. But I didn't feel the effects of alcohol quite yet. It wasn't until I was about 11 years old. And I went over to my friend Mike's house for the weekend. His mother had just gotten divorced, and she was on a manhunt. She had taken this guy out and got all of his money. She had the Porsche. She had the house. She had the beach house. She had all of this stuff. And she was going down to the beach with her girlfriend, and they were going to find men. And they just left us home, me, Mike, and his older sister, who was 15 years old. It seemed like it makes sense then. I would not leave my 15-year-old son in charge. But back then, it was a little bit different. That's what she did. And she pulled out of the driveway, and I don't even think the exhaust fumes were gone. And I said to Mike, I said, let's hit the liquor cabinet. I'm 11 years old. Let's hit the liquor cabinet. It was my first instinct, my first thought. I had to have been thinking about it well ahead of time. So he's like, what are we going to have? And I said, no problem. We're going to have screwdrivers. That's what we're going to have because I know how to make those. And, back then I felt like a big shot. Obviously now it's not that complicated. I think boiling water is a little bit more complicated than making a screwdriver. But we broke out these really big tall glasses. We got the orange juice out. We got the vodka out. And we filled it up 90% orange juice, 10% vodka. And I drank that and I put it down real quick. I barely even felt the burn. There was no effects. There was nothing. And I said, let's do another. We did another and we kept doing them. And the ratios kept changing. Eventually we got back to 90-10. But at the end, we were 90% vodka, 10% orange juice. And I'm putting it down. Now I'm feeling the burn and I'm familiar with that burn. That's what I like. And I know that I've got it right because I'm feeling that burn. And then I said to Mike, I said, Mike, when I came in, I noticed in the garage, we always went in through the garage, I noticed in the garage up on the shelf, there's a bunch of six packs of Michelob. So why don't we have a couple of those? And he said, no, my mom's going to notice that they're gone. I said, no, we just take them from the back, she'll never notice it. And when she does, it'll be long gone. So I said, all right, so we got a couple of those, and they were warm. They were a little nasty, but I put those down. I had three or four of those. And I have to tell you that all of this happened probably in about a 35-minute period. I mean, I was just chugging it down. And I finally felt the effects of alcohol for the first time in my life. And I can tell you what happened. It was amazing. It was a spiritual awakening. It was my very first spiritual experience. I'm telling you, my life changed in that moment. I went from feeling less than inadequate. I felt tall, handsome, intelligent. I felt hopeful. I felt there was a guy in school that I wanted to beat up. I was going to kick his butt. There was a girl that I wanted to ask out. And no matter, I was going to ask her out, her sister, all the friends, everybody. I wanted the phone. I was like, get me the phone book. Let's call them. We're going to take care of all this business. And this all happens like 40 minutes. And then unfortunately what started happening was everything started spinning. And I'm seeing twos and threes and fours of everything. And this is, I had not planned on. I didn't know what was going on. And then, you know, the vomiting, it's projectile vomiting, and it's just horrible. And I mean, I pass out, I come to, I'm covered in all my vomit. It's all nasty. I end up having to go home. I get in trouble. Now, my father was in the Marine Corps. First, he was in the Navy. He wanted to go in the Navy SEAL program. He got booted out of that because of his hearing. He left the Navy. He got an honorable discharge from there. He goes to the Marine Corps. He wants to fly choppers. Thinks he can get through because they picked up on the hearing again. He said, I'm going to be a door gunner. They wouldn't let him be a door gunner. They gave him an honorable discharge. My dad is like, he is a tough guy. He is not a fun, loving guy. I mean, if it hurts, that's fun. You know what I mean? If it's painful, that's fun. That's my dad. And it was not a good deal having to deal with him, you know, because he's in AA at this point. He's in AA. And here I am. I'm plastered. And I'm hungover now, and I have to go to work with him. This is part of my punishment. And he is a hardcore blue-collar worker. He owns an auto parts warehouse. He's got all these trucks and all these guys that he works for, and I mean, works for him, and so on and so on. He's just a tough, rugged guy. And I have to go to work for him, and I got to ride around in his junky truck and deal with him and listen to his lectures, and it was just horrible. And this is first thing in the morning. And he takes me to one of his accounts, and you know, he goes in there and he comes out and he's trying to do the right thing. He knows I have to be rehydrated. So what does he bring me? He brings me a cup of orange juice. And I smell that orange juice and that's my stomach just starts turning. I don't want anything to do with it. So I don't drink that. And then about an hour later, we're at another account. He comes out with water and a like a chocolate donut. And I was able to sip down the water. And my stomach settled down. Then I get a little bit of the donut, get some of that blood, you know, get some sugar in the blood, and so on and so on. I started to feel better, and I finished the donut, and I finished the water. And I started rehearsing, you know, I mean, going through everything that had happened the night before. And what I realized was that I had made a completely amateur mistake, is that you never, ever, ever mix warm Michelob with fruit juice. I mean, that was the worst thing in the world. That's why I got sick. If I didn't get sick, I would have never gotten caught. I wouldn't be in the situation that I'm in right now. I wouldn't have any of these problems. Totally amateur. And I went from this place where I was going to never, ever drink again. I swore off of alcohol when I was vomiting. The spins were so bad. They were hard. I didn't think they were ever going to stop. And I prayed, God, please make this stop. I swear I'll never do it again. And then that very morning, I am back to, I can drink on the weekends. I just don't, you know, won't ever mix fruit juice with Michelob again. Just can't do that. Problem solved. So I went from full circle, from, you know, having my first drink of alcohol, feeling the effects, a phenomenon of craving had kicked in, you know, everything had changed. I drank for the effect at that point, and I went from irritable, restless, discontented to feeling that sense of ease and comfort, which only comes at once by taking a few drinks, to swearing off alcohol for the rest of my life, to back to rationalizing how I can drink successfully. All in like a 24-hour period. I'm 11 years old. And my drinking continued like that for another 5-6 years. Any opportunity I had, I would lie, I would cheat, I would steal. I was drinking during the week. I was drinking in school. I was drinking after school. I was drinking in my bedroom. I had liquor hidden in my bedroom. I had it all over the place outside. My father thought that they were his from when he was drinking. He was finding these bottles, and he was like, I don't ever remember hiding these things out there, but I must have. And, you know, and I'm like, man, you know, he's getting my stash. And, you know, it's just the way that it was. Eventually, I end up in carrier clinic. A lot of people go to rehab. A lot of people don't like rehab. They hate going there. They dread it. I loved rehab. I absolutely loved, loved, loved rehab. I was away from my family. I was out of school. There was a lot of cute girls there, and there were no rules. It was perfect. All I had to do was just go to therapy every once in a while, play some pool, shoot some baskets. I didn't think the food was that bad. And it was really easy breezy. It was. I didn't want to leave. I wanted to stay. It was a great vacation for me. You know, but eventually, you know, the insurance said no more. They're not going to pay for it. My dad was sick and tired of paying out of his pocket for it. They pull me home, and I have to go to AA. It's all right. I was familiar with AA. I'd been to a couple meetings. My brother was there. My father was there at the time. And I start going to meetings, and I'm in the circle of all of their friends. And, you know, my dad, just so that you know, is no longer in AA. My older brother is no longer in AA. I'm the only person in the family that's in Alcoholics Anonymous, still sober today. Well, my dad's not drinking, but, you know, he's dealing with some untreated alcoholism, if you will. So I have to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm with his circle, their circle of friends. And most of those guys were just don't drink and go to meetings guys, which was fine. That's working for them. There's different types of alcoholics. It makes it very, very clear in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. There's a variety of different types of alcoholics. And if you're the type of alcoholic that can just not drink and go to meetings, my hat is off to you. I think that's awesome. I want to kill people when I do that. I want to kill people, and I want to kill myself. And that's exactly what happened, was that I arrived at a place, sitting in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, that I was going to commit suicide. And I had an entire list of people that I was going to take out. And they were going to go, obviously, I had to get them out before I take myself out. And there was this one morning where I just couldn't take the pain anymore. And I just decided, I was just, forget it. I'm not going to take those people out. I'm just going to drive off of this bridge. And I was on Route 95, and I was going to drive off the overpass down onto Route 1, down the Lawrenceville area. And, you know, I hit that pedal, and I'm gripping the wheel, and I know that it's coming. And I don't know what happens, but I don't steer off the road. And there was this thought in my head that said, why don't you go to the meeting tonight and see if there's really something to this program? That wasn't me. That wasn't me. I didn't think that. I didn't want to go to a meeting. I was sick and tired of AA. I was sick and tired of hearing, just don't drink, go to meetings, be good to yourself, all that frothy emotional appeal. You know what I mean? You know, go back to school. What you need is a better education, you know? Whatever it is, go get a massage, take a bubble bath, whatever it is. You know, I mean, you hear all of these things. And it's funny, but the problem is that it kills people like me. You know, and it works for non-alcoholics, or it works for the people that can just not drink and just be good to themselves. It works for them. But for this guy, it doesn't work. That stuff keeps me really, really sick, and it's going to kill me. You know, what I needed to have was a solution that had depth and weight. I needed to be told exactly what it was that I was dealing with, that I have a physical allergy to alcohol, that once I put alcohol in my body, there's this thing called a craving that develops, and it's called the phenomenon of craving. It's a phenomenon because it's unexplainable. I'm sure science, and I hear all these different things, that science talks about all these different things that it is and so on and so on. Well, if they know what it is, then they haven't solved it. You know what I mean? It hasn't happened yet. I haven't had anybody yet that went to a doctor, that came back, they identified what the problem was with alcoholism, and they can drink successfully yet, where they gave them a pill. I haven't heard about it, and if they do, I don't want anything to do with it. You know? So I needed this message of depth and weight, and I needed to know that my real problem wasn't even alcohol. The alcohol was my solution. And that was the truth. And that was really tricky for me to get my head around, that alcohol was my solution. And that is the truth, because alcohol kept me alive long enough to make it to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcohol took the pain, took the edge off of all that pain that I was dealing with when I was stone cold sober. You know, and that probably sounds pretty strange to a lot of people, hearing that alcohol is the solution. You know, sure is. Sure is. For this guy, it was. But now that I'm sober, now I'm irritable, restless, and discontented all over again, and alcohol is no longer going to solve my problem. I need something else. My problem is a spiritual malady, you know, a spiritual malady. And Big Book makes it very, very clear. It says when a spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically. And I wasn't hearing that. I was not hearing that message. I learned about that through reading the Big Book. How that started happening was I went to that meeting that night. And it's the Wednesday night men's meeting. I didn't like it. I didn't like all the guys there. And, you know, I mean, I don't have a problem going to men's meetings, but it was just like, I just didn't like those guys. It was, you know, this huggy-feely, feel good and be good to yourself garbage. You know, and I'm standing around this literature table, and there's this, you know, there's a book that just, it just jumps out at me. It's called New Pair of Glasses. And I open it up, and I don't open up the first page. I just open up to any random page, and I start reading. And there's a part in there where Chuck C. gets this call from this doctor at like 10 o'clock at night. And the doctor's calling him to ask him about love. He said, Chuck, what's your definition of love? And Chuck said he's got a pretty good sense of humor, and I think he's quite irritated he was being woke up at 10 o'clock at night. And he says, it's the same at 10 in the morning as it is at 10 at night. Why are you calling me now? And the doctor he begged him. He said, please, just tell me, what is your definition of love? And Chuck said, my definition of love is an action. You do something for someone else for free and for fun, expecting nothing in return. And that floored me. That floored me. I had never in my life done anything for anybody without expecting something in return. There was always a price tag associated with anything and everything that I'd done, especially while sitting in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because when you're sitting in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and I'm sober, now I'm kind of like entitled to things. You know what I mean? I'm entitled to a better life and I'm sober and I'm doing the right thing and all this garbage, you know, and I'm dying here. And then I read this and it changes my life in an instant, in an instant. And that's where it's like that part in the big book where it says, you know, how it works, where it says, God, may you find him now. Now, I found him right then in an instant. I had heard the truth. They say the truth will set you free. And the truth is that I heard that truth and it really wasn't very attractive to me. It really wasn't. But it hit home and I knew that that was the truth, that I wasn't free and for fun. There was always price tags associated. So I grabbed that book because I knew that I needed to read this book. I grabbed it. I went home. I read the entire book that night. I fell asleep, woke up in the morning, I started reading it again. Over the course of the next few days, I read it over and over and over again. Every time I read it, it kept hitting me, you know, right in the heart. I started learning more and more about myself, what it was that I was dealing with, what this disease was. I could identify so much with Chuck. I hadn't heard anybody talk like that before. Chuck was talking about the good book. He was talking about the big book. So I got this big book, and it was my brother's big book that he had given to my father, and there was a really nice message written in there that I thought was really touching, and, you know, I started reading that book, and there was a lot of verbiage in there that I just didn't understand, just kind of going over my head, but I would read it anyway, and I wasn't getting hung up on it. I just kept going through it, just kept pushing through it, and I was doing a lot of prayer and a lot of meditation, early stages, you know, even suggested in a four-step, we meditate on these things, and I'm meditating on some of this stuff, and you know, I needed someone to take me through this book, but I didn't know anybody who was going to do it. I met this one meeting in Princeton one night, and there'd been this guy that's been walking through Princeton. This freak. He's got his head shaved. He's got one little tuft of hair up here. And he's got it's colored. It's like multicolored. He was just a weird dude. He was slender. He wasn't that tall, and he wore Birkenstocks and all sorts of stuff. And I was like, this guy's a freak. And he walks into the meeting one night, and he's balancing this book up on his head. And I thought, oh, my God, here's this guy. And, yeah, I'm immediately judging this guy. Make a long story short, we end up started talking. And then, like, in the course of, like, a minute, I knew I needed to work with this guy. You know, I knew I needed to work with the guy. I asked him, I said, well, what's the deal with the big book on your head? And he's like, well, I have my hands in my pocket. Okay. All right. Why do you keep bringing your big book to them? You know, I always see you with the big book. And he said, well, would you go to a bar without your wallet? I said, it's fair enough. That's reasonable. And we started talking about it. I started asking him questions. He said, I think you need someone to take you through it. And he said, I'd be happy to take you through it. And as we started going through this book, he had told me that he had a big resentment. He's a very bright guy, very, very bright guy. He was getting his doctorate degree at Princeton. And he had this huge resentment against Harvard. And I was like, oh, Mr. Big Shot here. And because he really wanted to go to Harvard. He was just bent out of shape that he didn't get accepted to Harvard. And then we were going through this, and we were about halfway through it. He said, you know, Eric, I've come to realize that me coming to Princeton had nothing to do with not getting into Harvard or anything to do with that or me going to this school. It had everything to do with me meeting you and going through these 12 steps, because there was a pocket of people here that needed this. And that was the truth, you know. And right there I realized, there's free and for fun. No price tags associated, right there. You know, he'd gotten over his resentment. He was clear. He was an open channel. He was asking for the guidance and direction. He wanted to go to Harvard. He wasn't hanging on to forcing his way into Harvard. God wanted him to go to Princeton, and that's where he came. And he came here willingly and freely, and he did this stuff, you know. Changed my life. We went through that book. We started at the forwards. You don't hear too many people talking about the forwards anymore. You don't hear about the percentages, the way people used to recover. You know, I think off the top of my head, I think it was 50% of the people got sober first time when they made it to Alcoholics Anonymous. Now we hear these percentages like 2 or 3 or 5%. I think maybe I heard 10% not too long ago. I thought that was a bit of a stretch. 10% of the people that make it here recover, you know, because I see so many people come in and out and in and out. And what's crazy about this deal is that people will spend 40, 50, 60 grand to go to a rehab. And what do they tell you when you're in a rehab? If we were on a rehab right now and I were the director, I'd say, look to your left, look to your right. Only one of you is going to be sober in, you know, 30 days from now. And I'd say that's like 90%, 96% failure rate. You know, and you can come to AA, throw a buck in a basket or don't. And rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. You know? Save yourself 50 grand and just come to AA and work these 12 steps.
It's water. Look at that.
You know? So the percentages back then were 50% of the people that made it into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous got it the first time. The remaining, you know, the ones that went back out, they went out one time, 25% of them got it. And then basically when you did the math, it came out to approximately, with maybe one relapse or two, about 75% of the people got it. Those are good numbers, man. Those are really good numbers. And I ask myself, and I think about this, and when I go to different meetings, I look around, and I look at the actions people are taking, and I listen to what they're sharing, and then I kind of see what they do outside of the rooms, and I try to figure out what's different, because I wasn't there then. But I can tell you what I see now and what I hear now doesn't match up to what we read in our book. You know? And I think that that's the big difference. I think that that's the big difference. I think like in the 12 and 12, they talk about raising the bottom. I don't know where the heck Bill got this idea that you could raise the bottom, that somehow we've got the power that we can raise someone's bottom. I don't know where we get this idea. I can't raise anybody's bottom, man. You know, I can't raise the bottom. I can't do that for you. I can't do it. I couldn't do it for myself. I just can't raise that bottom, you know. But when we hear, you know, in the big book, it says we have two choices, you know. We're doomed to an alcoholic death, or we have to live a life based on spiritual principles. Timmy hears that from me all the time, and Timmy reminded me of this one night. We were driving home from a meeting. We're sitting outside my house, and he said, you know, it doesn't matter how long you've been sober. You're still faced with those two alternatives, doomed to an alcoholic death or living your life based on spiritual principles. I'm almost 30 years sober, and I am telling you that today I am still faced with those two choices or solution, whatever it is, doomed to an alcoholic death, or live my life based on spiritual principles. There's nothing else. There's nothing else. Not for this one. You know? So, I could go on and on about that. And I mean, I don't want to, I feel like I'm lecturing. I don't want to lecture, but, you know, that's not the thing that I want to put out there. I'm just trying to say that, you know, after 30 years, I see a lot of people that go in and out and die from this deal, and people sitting in our rooms that are suffering right here, and the solution is just sitting right here, right under our nose. You know, the other things I've learned is that this is not an intellectual program. This is a spiritual program. You can think this deal all you want. You can read it and try to figure it out all you want. I mean, I sponsor some brilliant people. I mean, just these guys are just geniuses. I mean, it's ridiculous how intelligent they are. They can't get it. They can't get it. You know, I can't get it through their head. I don't know how to get it through their head, and it's not necessarily my job to get it through their head. It's my job just to take them through the 12 steps, walk them over to God, and put their hand in God's hand and walk away, you know? But I can't get these guys to understand that this is not an intellectual. You cannot think your way through this deal. You can't. It's going to be spiritual actions, and you're going to get spiritual results, you know? It's crazy. It's crazy. I don't know how to get beyond that with that. I continue to pray, and I try to do it through my own actions. My life is, I would say, daily. More than daily. It is definitely daily. It's the 11th step. You know, I seek through prayer and meditation to improve my conscious contact with God as I understand Him. You know, praying only for the knowledge of His will for me and the power to carry that out. I can't tell you how that has changed my life. It has completely changed my life. I think it was you that said, you know, I spoke here about a year ago, and he said, well, it's a spiritual program. You should have new experience, da, da, da. And I'm definitely a different person than I was a year ago. That's for sure. And, you know, I'm a different person than I was yesterday. I think I'm a different person than I was this morning, you know, because I continue to have these experiences, and I continue to have to keep trusting in God with everything. Everything. Right down to my relationship with my wife, to my relationship with my children. Our car ride out here, we almost got killed on the way out here. Timmy Boy was a little slow on the uptake there. We almost got involved in a rear ender, which was a rear ender, and so on. And, it was a close call, but we got here. Since we sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God. And throughout that step, it talks about that this is a vital thing. It talks about that sixth sense and that we're going to be inspired, you know. And all of my life, I had to kind of think things through and plan it out, try to arrange things mentally and put everybody in their place, kind of like that actor who's trying to run the show, trying to arrange all the players all the time. And when I started going, you know, when you go through this stuff, you know, eventually you get to a point where you don't have to arrange the players so much anymore, as much as you have to align yourself with your higher power, you know. And that's what I try to do all the time. And, you know, my routine typically is I wake up, my wife brings me a coffee. She's pretty awesome. Every morning she comes in, she wakes me up with a cup of coffee. She's something else. I read some spiritual literature. I do some prayer. I do some meditation. Then I get up and I do some work. And then once I'm a little bit more awake, I go back and I do some more prayer and some more meditation. I'm constantly listening to spiritual lectures and constantly reading spiritual lectures or listening to them on my phone. I download them from the library and I listen to different spiritual books and so on and so on. And I have I try to lead my life based on inspiration. I try to be inspired. And it can be pretty frustrating for my wife sometimes because, you know, she wants an immediate answer and sometimes I just don't have one for her. Like, she'll want to go do something. She'll want to make a big decision. I'm like, I don't know. I just don't know. And I'm not going to do anything until I know. You know, I just won't do anything until I know. And sometimes it's going to be a pain. It's going to be a motivator. It's like, I kind of know, but I don't know. And it's like, I want God to come down and say, Eric, really, it's like, it's right here in the booklet. You know, this is the one I want you to do. But it doesn't always happen that way, and I'm not always inspired, but I kind of go with the feeling. It's got to be a spiritual feeling, you know, and I will know internally what it is. And recently I had one of these situations where it was something that was pressing, and it was pressing for a while. And I didn't know whether I was going to sell some of this deal that I had or what. I arrived at a place where I was like, I have to sell something. And, you know, I decided that I was going to sell an interest that I had in a company or part of it. And I put it out there to some people, and this guy responds right away. He says, I'll take it. I said, okay, great. And what was amazing was that instantly he turned into a really mean, nasty person. And I've known this guy for years. And I was like, well, what is this about? I thought, you know, I've known you for like 20 years. We're friends. I mean, you're really kind. You're a nice guy. What just happened here? Then there was all these accusations that started coming up. It's like, wait, no. This is not a spiritual experience for me right now. This is becoming very, very ugly. I don't like this. And the truth is that it was a really uncomfortable thing for me to do, but I had to withdraw from that, you know? And I didn't want to do that because I don't know if I have another buyer or not. I just don't know if I have another buyer or not. But the thing is that who am I trusting? Am I trusting in myself? Am I trusting in these other people? Or am I trusting in God? You know, and it was just one of those situations that it just didn't feel right. I knew that it was wrong. And I knew that if we continued down that path, it was going to get uglier and uglier. And I just didn't want to have that anymore. So I withdrew from that situation. And I opened it up and I was trusting in God, and then someone else pops up and says, I would be really interested in that. And they're a very, very close, dear friend of mine. They stepped up, were able to put it together, and it just fell right into place in a perfect way. And it felt exactly right. You know, it was just exactly right. And that's kind of been my experience through AA. The more that I practice this stuff, the more that I trust in God, these things start to feel exactly right. And that's what kind of happened with me and my wife. I didn't tell you that. When I was sitting in these rooms, before I really got into these steps, I'd fallen in love with this woman, my wife, and it was, I didn't feel like I was in her league. She was way out of my league. She's too darn pretty. She's too darn smart. She comes from too good of a family, and, you know, she's prep school, private school, educated, you know, all of this stuff, everything that I am not, and I felt less than and inadequate. I knew that, you know, one day she's just going to discover that I'm not good enough. And part of my defects of character are when I'm in that situation, I have to abuse you. Just the way that it is. And, you know, it's not nice. It's not nice. But, you know, that's the way that I did it. It was the only way that I felt secure. So what I had to do is I got to keep her on her toes. So, you know, it was just a lot of mental, spiritual, and emotional abuse. And my defects of character told me that that was the way to establish, a safe position in this relationship. And what was happening was I was hurting her and pushing her further and further away. Ultimately, we ended up having a son. And right after my son was born, she just couldn't handle it anymore. It was too much. Most of her family had moved back to Ireland, and she just said, I can't do it. And she hopped on a plane and moved back to Ireland with my son. And I was absolutely devastated. I was crushed. I mean, I was so heartbroken. And I was filled with resentment. I couldn't believe that she could do this to me. How dare she do this to me? And I walked around the rooms telling everybody that, you know, this woman had kidnapped my child. You know, you get a lot of mileage out of that, you know. Talk about wanting some frothy emotional appeal. Walk into a meeting and tell people that your son was kidnapped, and boy, you will get it, you know. You know, and it gave me a lot of excuses, you know, just to be grumpy, to be mean, to be nasty, and so on. And, you know, and that's just the way that it was, you know. But when I got into these 12 steps and I continued through them and I got up to that 9-step and I have to make these amends process, go through the amends process, you know, I was working with another guy, you know, not really working with, but working with him, you know, he was another very bright guy with a lot of experience. And he said, I think you need to go to Ireland. I said, I can't go to Ireland. You know, I'm not even allowed to see my child. I'm not allowed on the property. They left the country to get away from me. Da, 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 da. He said, I didn't ask you about any of that stuff. I think you need to go to Ireland and go over there and see your son. I said, I don't know if I can. He said, it's the leap of faith. Just go over to Ireland and see if you can see your son. And the first experience was really, really rough. You know, it was in Dublin, Phoenix Park, on the other side of Phoenix Park. And, you know, I have to stand on one side of the road. And this person who I don't know brings my son over to me. And I get to see my son for about 10 minutes and they go away. And, I, you know, it was just one of the most awkward things in the world to have to do that. And I didn't even see Kim or anything like that. It was very strange. And that's the way those 10 days went. See, because I went for 10 days, you know. Because I think it's going to, you know, maybe if it works out, you know, who knows, we'll spend a little time together because I'm one of those guys, you know, didn't work out that way. She was kind of like, definitely stay away from me because I saw her on like the 5th day. Basically, she just still didn't want anything to do with me. And I was, again, heartbroken. It was a very lonely time sitting over there, you know, in the hotel room at night by myself, not knowing anybody. I would go to a couple meetings and I came back and, you know, JC was like, you got to send her some money. Just said, you know, she's got loads of money. So I didn't ask you if she has money, but you have to send money. It's your kid. It's your responsibility. So I started sending money over there. Then around his birthday, I was sending presents over, holidays, sending stuff over, and so on and so on. And then at one point, it started to come back together. We got back together for a brief time, and these defects just flared back up. I hadn't let go of them yet, and I really wasn't trusting God completely. And that was it. It blew up. It just blew up completely at this point. And there was no talking to her. She didn't want anything. I was forbidden to ever even come to Ireland again. And I honored that. I really did. I didn't know what to do. I just knew that I couldn't pull this deal together. I stayed away for 4 or 5 years. She stayed away from me for 4 or 5 years. And unfortunately, I didn't get to see my son for 4 or 5 years. I didn't, you know, nothing. No gifts, no cards, no nothing. And it was a really ugly time. It was very, very difficult for me. I was heartbroken. I was dating, like, women, like, to the best of my, any woman that would date me, I was going to date, you know, and it was just like trying to fill that hole, trying to fix this, trying to forget her, trying to forget the son, trying to forget everything, you know, just doing everything that I can instead of just trusting in God, you know, instead of just trusting God. And it was one particular night after I was at a nightclub and, you know, and I went home and I just felt absolutely horrible and miserable about myself. And I just couldn't get this woman off of my mind. And I hit my knees and I started praying. I was praying, honestly, from this place where, I didn't care whether I was going to see my son again or see her again. I just wanted this pain to stop. And I asked God to please remove this obsession that I had with her and with my son. Please remove this obsession that I have with this situation. Please remove this pain. And then, like, the prayers became inspired. It was really weird. Like, I was asking God, like, I pray that you bring a man into her life that's going to be the perfect husband. He's going to take really good care of her. And he's going to be the perfect father for my son. And so on and so on. It, you know, just all of that. And what happened was these pieces just started to fall away. You know, like, this obsession, like, I wasn't holding on to it so much anymore. And when I was done praying, I got into bed, and I fell right asleep. You know, I had a beautiful night's sleep, and I woke up in the morning, and I had to go into work, and she was not the first thing on my mind. My son wasn't the first thing on my mind. That was really strange, because I didn't even notice it, you know? Didn't even notice it until later on. I got up, took my shower, went into work. I'm walking into my father's office, and he's on the phone, and he's pointing at the phone as I'm walking in. I hear him say, hold on, he's walking in right now. And I look over, and I think it's probably a client or something like that. And he's pointing at the phone. He says, it's Kim. I said, who? He said, Kim from Ireland. I said, what? And I picked up. I said, hello. And she said, it's been far too long. I'm moving back to the United States. I'll see you in 2 weeks. And hung up. After like 4 or 5 years. And it was an immediate result from that night before when I was praying. I just wanted it over. I just wanted the obsession to go away. And I really had just let go of it. You know, God had acted. God knew what he wanted to do all along. I was the one who was in the way. You know, the moment I got out of the way, that was it. That was it. She was back. You know, we got back together. It wasn't a smooth, easy ride. You know, I am not an easy guy to deal with, I promise you. She is, I don't even know what to say. She's amazing. She really hung in there with me. We ended up getting married. We got married because a buddy of mine said, you know, if you don't ask her to marry you, she's going to leave you. And I was like, what? Really? Like, I abuse her, she leaves me. Now if I won't marry her, she'll leave me. So I went home to her. I said, honey, are you going to... You know, leave me if I don't marry you? She said, I want to spend the rest of my life with you, and if you won't ask me to marry you, I'm going to leave the man that I want to spend the rest of my life with. She's like, that doesn't make any sense. And I said, okay. Do you want to get married? You know, it was one of those. And she's like, I don't know. I don't feel like I need to be married. Do you feel like you need to be married? I said, I don't feel like I need to be married, but if you want to be married, I'll marry you. And, you know, really romantic, right? And she's like, well, I don't know. Let's just see how things go. So I said, okay. And then it was on me, you know? I mean, I wanted to marry her, you know? I wanted to marry her. And what happened was I started to let go of this vulnerability. I started to allow myself to be vulnerable. I was like, I want to be married to this woman. That's really what I want to do. So I went out and I bought her a ring, and still full of fear, hotshot that I am, I sitting in the living room, I tossed the ring at her in her lap and said, what do you think of that? And she, yeah, not very romantic, but you know, I still have to protect myself. What if she said no? Even though I knew she was going to say yes, but what if she said no? You're down on your knee. Would you marry me? No. You know, I couldn't face that. You know, so I asked her to marry me by throwing a ring. She said yes. We had to return the ring. It was the wrong one. I kind of knew that was going to happen, but that was okay. And then I did what was the right thing to do, which was I called her father. I didn't do it in the right order. I think I was supposed to call him before I asked. But I wanted to know it was a sure thing before I had to face this guy. So I called him up, and this guy hated me. He hated me for the longest time. Hated me for the longest time. But what happened was a few months before that, he had come over from Ireland, and I owned this little restaurant. And the whole family was in my restaurant. And was a little sketchy because, you know, it's my place, and I know he's kind of out of his territory, he's in my territory, but I don't want him to feel that way, and, you know, so on and so on. So when the bill comes out, I said, it's on the house, don't worry about it. He was very, you know, he was very grateful for it. We all go outside, we're all smoking, we're having cigarettes, and then suddenly everybody has got to get up and go away and leave me there with this guy. And I'm like, what? You guys are killing me, leave me alone with them. So I just said a silent prayer. I said, God, please just help me keep my mouth shut. And he looked at me and says, my daughter looks happier than she ever has. And I believe I have you to thank for that. And this is the same man that was, you know, stay away forever. So I called him up and I said, look, I think you know why I'm calling. I'd like to ask you for permission to marry your daughter. And, you know, he lets out this big scream. Yes, you can, you know, yes, you may. And so on and so on. Everybody was all excited and da 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 da. And I don't know why I'm going on and on about this, but I can tell you that the only reason any of this happened was because I worked these 12 steps, you know, and I asked for guidance and direction, and I prayed, and I meditated, and I allowed myself to be vulnerable, and I practiced these principles in the most important place, I think, which is my home. You know, I come here to get, you know, to get the information, to get the fuel, whatever it is, but when I walk out that door, that's the most important place where I'm going to practice these principles, you know, and I practiced them, you know, in the home there with them. And, you know, my wife and I ended up having a second child, and he was born with a bunch of heart defects, and he needed immediate heart surgery or he was going to die. And he was on a life support machine, and it was looking like he was going to die anyway. And when they were going to take him off life support, they basically said, look, he's going to die. Or he's going to flatline, we're going to put him back on, and we're going to put him on a list for a heart transplant. And I'm devastated. I wasn't there for my first son. Now this is going to happen with this one, and I don't even know what to do. And, you know, my wife is absolutely devastated. Her whole family's over in Ireland, and it's just she and I in a hospital. And, you know, I just said to her, I said, look, would you like me to fly your family over to be here of support for you? And she looked at me, and she said, no. You are my pillar. You are my rock. You're the only thing that I need. And this is the same woman that was leaving me. You know, this is the animal that I was. And, you know, you just add some 12 steps to this, a little spiritual work, and you become a different person. I'm not trying to get anything out of this deal. I'm trying to bring something to it. And suddenly I've become her pillar, and I never, ever tried to do that. I never tried to put myself in that type of position with her. I just wanted to give, you know, just try to clean up that record. My son, by the way, did come off the life support machine. He did not flatline. He did not die, and he did not need a heart transplant. They really don't know, you know, what happened with him. They don't know why he got as sick as he did, and they don't know why he got as healthy as he did. And I happen to think that it, you know, had a lot to do with God. I don't know that God necessarily picks and chooses like that. But I know that morning when I went down into that chapel, it was really scary knowing what I was going to be facing that day, him coming off. And I prayed, and I told God, I said, you know, I'd really like to put in a request right now, but I don't know if that's the right thing to do. I said, but the one thing I'm going to ask you to do is that if you do choose to take my boy today, I'm going to ask you to please save me from being angry at you. You know? Because I know if I get angry at God, and if I lose my son, and I'm angry at God, and I feel like he did this, I'm done. I'm toast. I'm out of here. I know it. You can imagine, you know. And that wasn't the situation. That wasn't the situation. He came off the life support machine. He's healthy as a horse. He's tall as can be. He's doing absolutely fabulous. I told you that my wife and I had a couple of bumps in the road, and we did a few years ago. We hit a bump, and I'm not exactly sure what happened, but I know that we were considering a divorce. We were just not in a good place, and I was not thrilled about that. I was in a lot of pain. I was really struggling with it. I wasn't trying to force the marriage to work, but I was kind of like just brokenhearted over it. And I was sitting in meditation one day, and I was kind of not getting used to the idea, but I was trying to accept the fact that I was going to end up getting a divorce, and that I was going to be a single dad, and she was going to be a single mom, different residences, weekend warrior, all of this stuff. I wasn't thrilled with it. It was not my ideal. And I just sat there, and I sat in that meditation with that for quite a while. And then I was able to just kind of get my mind quiet. And out of the blue, I heard this voice. Not like you hear my voice now, but I heard it in my head. And it said, you didn't bring her into your life, and you can't keep her there. But I did, and I can. And the weight of the world just rolled off my shoulders. And I wasn't worried about it anymore. I had no more fear about what was going to happen. It was just gone. It was completely gone. And I got up, I walked out of the office, I went downstairs, and I did something that I probably will never ever do again, which is I grabbed the ladder and newspaper and Windex and went outside and started cleaning windows. And just seemed like the next right thing to do. And I'm out there, and we hadn't talked for about 6 weeks, and I'm out there cleaning these windows. And it's only a couple minutes afterwards I can feel her presence behind me. And it was another one of those moments where it's like, God, please help me just keep my mouth shut, you know. And I turn around and I look at her, and she says, I have two tickets for the theater tonight. Would you be my date? I said, of course I would. And we've never talked about divorce ever again. You know, that is, it's just been gone. But one of the things that I can tell you that's been happening is that I've definitely upped my game in terms of practicing these principles more and more in the house and getting out of the way and recognizing that my role as a husband isn't so much it's to be more support, to be more loving, more kind, and so on and so on. It was only about a year and a half ago, I was at the top of the steps, and we had a conversation, and everything was fine. I was walking away, and she said, hon, and I stopped, and I turned around, and I said, yes, and she said, I want you to know I've never felt so safe with you. And I said, did you ever feel unsafe? And she said, no, I've never felt unsafe, but I've just never felt so safe, you know? And that blew me away. That blew me away. And I can promise you that that was as a result of working these 12 steps. Working these 12 steps. And I know that if I continue to work these 12 steps, and I can continue to grow, I'm absolutely no danger of taking a drink today. No danger of taking a drink today. I don't have to worry about that strange mental blank spot. I don't have to worry about being on guard. I don't have to worry about avoiding people, places, and things. You know, all these ideas that give me this idea of power and control. I don't have to worry about those things. I can go anywhere, provided that my motives are right. I am safe and protected. And I've been some really, really crazy, insane, dangerous places, 12-stepping people. You know, I just don't have the desire to drink. It's only happened to me one time. And it was a beautiful afternoon. I was sitting at my wife's aunt's house. The sky was just crystal clear. It was a beautiful blue. The clouds were nice and big and puffy, and they were just whipping by. The breeze was perfect, and there were some people drinking. And I thought, you know, I think I can have a drink. I think I can have a beer. It just occurred to me right out of the blue. I think I can have a beer. I said to my wife, I said, hon, I think I can drink. And she said, I think that's a pretty slippery slope. I said, well, maybe. And she said, why don't you call your sponsor? And everybody started hearing it. When they heard that conversation, people were clearing out, you know. And they started walking towards the house, and my wife started walking towards the house, and my phone rang. And she turned around, she looked at me, and she said, you know, is it Bob, my sponsor? And I said, it's Bob B. It's not Bob, my sponsor, but it's a guy I sponsor who is like 15 years now, and, you know, he's a very dear friend. And so I picked up, and we started talking, and I told him what was going on. And after about 30 seconds, I realized that I was, you know, a real alcoholic and that that was pure insanity. And, you know, it was just one of those moments again that thank God I'd done all the prayer and all the meditation and everything that I'd done, because otherwise I wouldn't have been open or available for that. You know what I mean? I wouldn't have been open and available for that, you know. And we had that conversation, that desire's gone. I haven't had that desire since. You know, like I said earlier, I don't know. I hope I didn't piss anybody off or give any resentments. If I did, you know, there's a 4-step, there's a 10-step, an 11-step. I don't know. Rarely have we seen a person fail as thoroughly followed our path. Thanks for letting me share.